Welcome back to the Missy Maura Murray podcast. I am Tim here tonight with Lance. Lance, what's up?
What's up? What's up? Feels good. How you doing?
Good. Episode 3 aired this past Saturday, and another pretty interesting episode. We get into the rag in the tailpipe a little bit. The interview with Kathleen finishes up. We mentioned some of the persons of interest, the Loon Three. What do you think?
I just think, and I don't know, tell me if you feel the same way, but I feel like every time we watch a new episode, it just sort of keeps ramping up a little bit. And I'm constantly impressed and reassured that this investigation is going in the right direction. Every time we watch an episode, I just shake my head and I say, I love the way they're presenting this information. The way that Kathleen's interview was brought back around and tied up at the end. Some would say there are still loose ends with Kathleen. At the end of that interview, it really does seem like no more than one sister being concerned for another sister and having that affect her emotionally during a time of stress in her life. So you can understand where that my sister comment comes from. And it's really cool to see that out there finally. And people are going to make what they'll make of it. You know, they'll say that, you know, some people are misremembering things, or maybe it was this or that. But if you just take it at face value, this is what most siblings would do if receiving a phone call about their other sibling. And it just seems to make sense. And I was glad to see Art and Maggie bringing that around and tying it up the best way that they could.
Also, we get to see Bob. Lance and I, you and me and Maggie went to see our buddy Bob in town. And Bob is actually from the podcast. He was on the West Point episode of this podcast. Of course, we called him Sam for that, but he was willing to show his face and be known as his real name on this show. So I think that was pretty cool. We talked a bit about Bill Rausch, and he kind of vouched for him, as far as he knows Bill, that he was a good guy. So I think that was interesting, because really that's one of the only accounts kind of such from people that we've known or talked to. Seems like the Murray family weren't crazy about him. Julie and Kathleen being the examples there. Fred said that he did like him, it seemed, in episode 3. But either way, we got to see Bob, and hopefully Bob comes back, because there was more of that conversation that we will get into, Lance, on the air here if the show doesn't go back into it.
It was a really cool surprise to see that they introduced Bob in episode 3, because the bulk of our conversation at that time really wasn't about what he had talked about, and I'm really pleased that they took that his perspective of West Point and his perspective of Bill, and thought that it was important enough to put it in the show, because we haven't heard from Bill. All we've heard about are people that are sort of on the peripheral of Bill, and not anybody who's really dealt with him in a situation like being at a military academy, where some true colors could really come out. Bob was great. Bob was great to talk to. I really do, like you said, I do hope that the substance of why we were there is presented in later episodes.
And so the bulk of this episode tonight, we're going to play the audio from our Facebook live chat that we did after the episode aired. It was on Oxygen's Facebook page. You can check that out on Oxygen's page, or we're going to play the audio right here. And if you notice, my voice is a little different. I actually lost it about halfway through this Facebook live session, or I started to lose it then. So sorry about that. Hopefully it'll be sounding normal next week.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to apologize to me. It actually felt like kind of a dream come true when you texted and said that you lost your voice, and I I thought it might have been that woman in Salem that I talked to and gave her the article of clothing that you own. I'm trying to somehow.
No, I was just gonna let you go. I was just gonna let you go. Keep going. Go ahead.
Keep going. Keep digging the hole.
Keep going. So the Loon 3 is really an interesting topic, and it seems to be the most common question that comes up after this episode. So Maggie and Art went to go see Dick Guy, who was an EMT, who was one of the first people on the scene of Maura's accident that night. And him and his partner first noticed the rag hanging out of the tailpipe. And so Dick actually talks about, you know, it made him think that someone put the rag in there and waited for the car to stall, you know, and follow Maura's car, and then waited for it to stall and then picked her up. And then he started talking about the Loon 3. So I think the show is going to get deeper into the rag and the tailpipe, and I think they're going to have a good answer for that in the next episode, in episode 4. But for us right now, we should just kind of focus on the Loon 3. Some of the names are actually familiar names to this case, and two of them are brothers, and one of them is a man who owned a red truck. So if you know this case well, you'll know what the red truck was. Lance, do you want to explain what the red truck is?
Well, the red truck was spotted by someone who was walking along the road that night, and a red truck passed her by and slowed down. And from her account, it seemed like the people operating the red truck were looking for somebody, and perhaps they had mistaken her as the person they were looking for because of how long they stopped and considered her. The red truck continued on. She walked up to the Swiftwater store up there that's right before the curve that Maura's car went off the road, and the red truck was there. She was able to see that it had those wood racks on the bed of the truck. It was like a medium-sized bed. She gave about the best description of a red truck she could give, with, you know, not knowing why she was trying to remember this. And it seemed like this truck was looking for somebody. So the owners, as far as we know, of this red truck have been connected to the theory of the Loon 3.
Right. The Loon Mountain had, you know, obviously has a lot of workers, but these were three men who were heading to work around the time the Moore went missing. Our locals maybe would have been driving down that road to get to Loon Mountain, and none of them showed up to work that night. So all three of them missed work that night. So it is suspicious, and it is something, if the show doesn't go into deeper, that we will hear, Lance, and we will talk about these people, and we will get deeper, and we will try to get to the bottom of it. But for now, until we can 100% confirm these names, you know, we're not going to really mention their names specifically here.
Right, because this theory has been out there for a little while about the red truck, and it's a bit of a slippery slope when you start to name names and say that this seems to make sense and it comes together, and these, you know, the two brothers and the other person, and they didn't show up for work. If Maura didn't go missing that night, right then and there, and that truck went through that road, and the same woman saw that truck and they slowed down because they might have thought that they recognized her, then we wouldn't even be, you know, this wouldn't be an issue. Maybe they encountered something later on that prevented them all from going to work. It all just could be a coincidence. But we do have this issue of the red truck, and it's never been fully tied up. And we will try to get to the bottom of it the best we can. You know, we do operate a lot off of sourced information and tips, and people saying, oh, no, this is the information that was out there, you know. There's a ton of information. We probably, you know, there's stuff that we miss because of everything that just keeps piling on top of it.
Do you know what the police feel about these three? Do you know how they feel?
Well, from what we know, I believe that the Loon 3 has not been officially determined persons of interest, but we can't say that they're not. We do know that they've been looked into, and if to say that they're persons of interest because they were looked into, then yes, at one point they were, but we're not sure exactly where the police stopped because they couldn't move any further, or where they stopped because, oh, these guys are just like strictly innocent.
Okay, so before we play the Facebook Live audio, we really only have a couple more topics here. And one of them was a very uncomfortable conversation that Maggie and Art had with Fred Murray. They talked about the potential of Fred sexually abusing Maura. Now, as far as what Fred said, I thought it was pretty good. You know, he was pretty insulted, I think, originally. Like, at first, he was kind of shocked that Maggie asked him that. But I think he answered it well, and I think, I believe him and everything, you know.
I remember when Maggie told us that she had to ask him that question, and she described his reaction, and they didn't do any creative editing there. That was the reaction that she described that he had. And I would say if you had any question about whether or not Fred abused any of his kids, watch his reaction. He is, first of all, a little bit dumbfounded. Almost like when you tell somebody a joke and they don't get it. And then they're like, what? Like, they're trying to figure out the joke. And then he realizes she's serious. And then she has to say, I have to ask you this. The whole chain of events with that short conversation that they had, you watch that, I think you can make up your own mind based on that reaction. I don't think I've ever seen anything, and I know I'm probably going to get a lot of crap for this, I don't think I've seen something as genuine from a direct question, from the answer of a direct question. I saw that and I said, that's about as genuine as I've ever seen. It was shock. It was disbelief. And then he started to get angry. Like, how could you even do that? How could you ask that? And it didn't seem contrived at all. Right.
And couple that interview with a clip from episode 4 that's out there on Oxygen site now. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's really heartbreaking to watch Fred talk about how he misses Maura and the memories of them playing in the front yard and climbing the tree and things like that. And it's really hard to watch. I don't know how you watch Fred's reaction to that difficult question and take anything else than what you just said.
And it almost will make you a bit angry as well, because it's like Fred was about the best father he could be to his children. People's parents get divorced all the time. Fred and his wife were estranged. They were going through a rough relationship. And if I always come back to the, if Maura wasn't missing, if she was here, then we wouldn't think about that. What he did to keep his family together. He saw that his daughters had ability in athletics and he pushed them to excel. I don't see a problem with that. I don't see a problem with taking your daughters or all of your kids out camping. And if you want to pitch a tent and you cook dinner and then you go to sleep in the tent outside, I wouldn't see a problem with that at all. But you throw in this, well, she's missing, and he was overly demanding of his kids, and you paint this picture of this, like, you know, this monster of a person who just demanded. And I mean, you know, like, we've been working on this for a little bit, for a few years, right? And there are times when you do get caught in thinking that these things could happen just because you're so influenced by all these outside sources, all this outside influence. But when you just look at it And it was a father who was keeping his family together. And his children had ability, an athletic ability. If your kid has music ability, you make sure that they practice piano. If your child has track ability, you make sure they run. If their time is this, you make sure they want to beat their time.
Yeah, and Fred says it in the interview. He said, you know, if a kid likes something, you push them to do it because they like it. They'll enjoy it, you know,
right.
And they can be good at it.
Right. Why would you do anything otherwise?
So if you want to read a little bit more on this, Renner has a statement out on his blog about this. And in fairness, Fred Murray has a statement out as well, and that's on John Smith's blog, and we'll link to both of them in the show notes if you want to look at both of them. We feel we need to address both of them if we talk about one of them. So, okay, so let's play the Facebook Live audio, Lance, and thank you everybody for listening. We will be back next week with another one of these to talk about episode 4. So check out episode 4 this Saturday night on Oxygen at 7 p.m. Eastern. Okay, thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter at Maura Murray Doc. Thank you very much. Hey, everybody. Welcome. I am Tim. This is Lance. We are here. We are of the Missing Maura Murray podcast, and we are here doing this Facebook Live chat after episode 3 of The Disappearance of Maura Murray aired on Oxygen.
And what an episode that was. Again, they just continue to start you off in one place, and by the time the episode is done, your brain has totally been turned around. There's a lot of information. I love the way they're delivering it too.
I agree. I can hardly even remember the beginning of the episode. By the time it gets to the end, it's your brain is all over the place.
Right. It's like you got to take notes for it. So hey guys, everyone seems to be joining on here. Hi Holly.
A lot of people are joining on. Hi John. Okay, so in the episode today, we started off with Kathleen. Finishing the interview with Kathleen, and so it seems like Maggie, Art, and Evie, everyone thinks that Kathleen has
nothing to do with Maura's actual disappearance, right?
And doesn't know anything.
But
about where Maura went, or that the My Sister comment, that's the point that I think is important here, that Maura's My Sister comment the night she made that comment at work, it does not mean that Kathleen knows where Maura was heading or anything.
Right. And it was very courageous of Kat to even do this interview. You know, you have somebody who is a body language expert talking about someone who's revealing things about her sister and the relationship she had with her sister. So she is going to be stiff and uncomfortable. However, Kat has a lot of unfounded guilt and anger. She even says that she has dreams, and in her dreams she's angry about more. Like, how could you do this to us? But she has a lot of guilt that I feel like she puts on herself. Like, she's compelled to have this guilt, and that makes her seem a little bit more, you know, like she stands out a little bit more as someone like, does she know anything more? But honestly, if you put yourself in her position, she feels bad. She feels bad. She feels guilty, and she feels angry. And you can't determine how someone's going to act based on that.
How would you not have guilt if it's your family member or your friend even, or your daughter?
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine the entire family has guilt because they think, wow, if I did something different, maybe this could have prevented Maura from taking this trip to New Hampshire, and maybe that could have prevented Maura from going missing.
Right. 13 years of what ifs.
Yeah, you can really drive yourself crazy, I'm sure.
Yeah. Hello from Texas. Dora, hello from Texas. Well, hello. Hope you're doing well in Texas.
So they also talked to Fred Murray in this episode. Pretty tense, some tense moments, I would say, with Fred. I was surprised that Fred said that he kind of liked Bill. Because basically everything else that had come out from Kat and Julie was, you know, this guy I'm not really sure about, whatnot.
And Fred actually said, Tony here says, Fred said Maura's car was not drivable. Yep, he said that Maura's car was not drivable, and that is pretty accurate. The car was drivable, but it wasn't, I mean, she obviously made it up to that point, but it was on its last legs.
Yeah, not drivable and not functioning is two different things. He didn't want his daughter in a car like that.
Right. If, you know, you're a dad, you definitely want your daughter to be driving a safe vehicle, and he did not feel that vehicle was safe at the time. So he explained that he went to several different ATMs to get money out, $4,000, in fact, to buy a new car for Mora.
Right.
And he said that they didn't do it. They didn't have enough money, enough cash. He said his normal bank was in Connecticut, so that's why he stopped at several different ATMs.
And ATMs have limits on what you can withdraw.
Right.
John Newman says, do you guys believe that Maggie and Art really debunked James Renner's theory in this episode after speaking with the clerk in Canada? I don't think anyone's looking to debunk anything. I think Maggie and Art are performing an investigation and doing the necessary follow-up. And based on what they found, I think they came up with a conclusion that seems reasonable, that after 10 years, they were shown a picture that was 10 years old. It's really tough to say that this person that they saw in that picture was Mora. They looked at a picture of a brunette young woman with dimples smiling. I can't imagine how many of those they get over the course of, you know, over the course of a week or a month or a year, yeah, let alone 10 years.
You're talking about the people in the record store?
After speaking with a clerk in Canada. Okay. I'm assuming that he meant the record store clerk.
Yeah, those are the only people they spoke to in Canada. So we were there. You know, I met those people too. I was there at that record store. You know, they did not say that Mora looked familiar at the time. They said, no, actually. They said, you know, they emailed about 2 weeks later. They emailed James Renner and said, actually, I think we might have known this woman, or we might have recognized this woman. But again, as you saw in the episode, the flyers that we were showing people, they were flyers from 2004. I mean, it was a picture from 2004 or earlier. So Mora wouldn't have looked like that now or in 2013. Absolutely. When we were in Canada doing this.
And also, I just want to bring out a couple of facts about crossing the Canadian border. When we went to Canada with James Renner, it was James, you, myself, our camera guy, Josh. We had Pelican cases with equipment in the vehicle, and they pulled us over and they searched the vehicle and they talked to us. And we talk about this on the podcast, and we, you know, it's not something that that people don't know about. I'm not revealing new information here, but they don't take it lightly. And especially right after 2001, this is 2004. If you're driving through if you're crossing continental borders, they're not taking it that lightly. If Mora was driving her car through there and she had someone else with her, maybe they got through, mm-hmm, without the car being checked. As far as we know, she had she had alcohol in the car. They would have had to have confiscated alcohol if it was in the car. They have to check these things when they go through. It's not as easy as people make it out to be.
Mm-hmm. Let's explain the situation. What happened when we went through the border, which was in 2013. They stopped us. We had camera equipment and we had missing flyers. So they sensed something was weird. You know, they pulled us out. We were sitting in their waiting room, I guess you want to call it, for like 20 minutes or so. And then they came up to us and said, "Who is Mora Murray to you?"
Also, there's documentation. There's cameras there. You can look at license plates. It's not that easy to just cross through the border. Especially back then, everyone was really hot on after 2001. Like, all of that tightened up. I remember before that, you can go through with just your license. You didn't even need a passport.
Right.
But everything had tightened up since then. And it's really hard for me to believe that she would be traveling in tandem with alcohol at that time of night through the border, and there wouldn't be anyone who comes forward and says anything about that.
Yeah. Maria says, the story of the young men from Loon. Wow. And so this is something that they touched on in the end of the episode, that there were three men who worked at Loon Mountain, which is, what is it, 12, somewhere somewhere between 10 and 20 miles from the accident site.
Mm-hmm.
And that they did not show up to work the night that Mora went missing. And so that maybe they would have been traveling on that road. it's tough to really speculate on that, but it is shady. I mean, it's a shady sounding story, at least, right? Who know, any number of things could have happened that day or the days before to prevent those three men from going to work that night.
Right.
But exactly. It sounds suspicious.
It does sound suspicious. And in the context of what happened to Mora, you put that together and yes, it sounds suspicious. This isn't just bringing up another red herring, as we've seen with the way the show has been going.
Yeah.
Red herrings are brought up and then they're kind of systematically dissected and dismissed if they have to be.
Yeah.
So this red herring's coming up, and I hate saying red herring, but it's the only thing that I can, it's the only word I can use. The only
well,
term
I don't
I can
know,
use.
We don't know if it's a red herring.
It's a thing. Right? Oops. It's a thing that's come up.
Yeah.
And what this show is going to do is show why you will or won't want to follow up on this. And yeah, the listening audience out there should start thinking about, you know, this Loon connection.
That is something to follow up on, absolutely. And Jeff here says, is that a theory that you guys have heard about, or is that something that we've heard about? And yes, we have heard of it. We hadn't heard them called the Loon Mountain 3 until they brought it up on the show. But yes, we had heard of that. Nancy says they never addressed the second police officer on the scene. And I mean the one Jeff Streslin spoke to Mary Beth Conway about. So maybe that is something that will be upcoming in the series. I think I know who you're talking about.
That's an interesting point there from Gina Marie, saying how many women went missing from the area around the time Mora disappeared. The most prominent case around that time period was Breonna Maitland in March.
About 6 weeks later.
Yep. About 90 miles from where Mora went missing. There's always cases of people going into the mountains, going hiking and getting lost in the mountains. But as far as we know, Breonna's the only other one that really stands out as something that's similar and perhaps relatable.
Yeah. Nancy again asks, why won't the New Hampshire State Police allow Cecil Smith to speak of the accident now? And I would say stand by.
It's an open investigation, so they got to figure it out.
I would just say keep watching.
Yeah. There was a good point there from Amanda Davis,
okay.
Who says she went to Canada that night. Great point.
Good point.
Good point.
Could have been any night. She didn't necessarily have to have alcohol in the car when she crossed the border.
Yep.
But she obviously didn't take her car if she did. So the question is whose car would
right.
she have been
but
in?
But it's that kind of thinking that I really like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's endless scenarios if she's there. I mean, she could have walked over the border. I mean, we've heard. But from investigating the Breonna Maitland disappearance, we know that there's areas without fences in Vermont that connect into Canada, and you can just walk over there. In fact, when we were in that area, our cell phones registered that we were in Canada.
Oh, yeah, at some point you'd take over a Canadian cell phone
I mean, we were like 100 yards or something from Canada without there being a border crossing there. So it is possible.
Sometimes we get so caught up in the minutiae of what we do that kind of thinking, again, is what I like. Who says she went there that night? That's just this way of thinking that, you know, you just get too caught up in it sometimes, and you need somebody with that that perception to let you know that there's another scenario there.
Jason asks for a shout out from Tim and Lance, and sorry, we cannot give you a shout out.
Sorry, Jason.
So what about the awkwardness with Fred Murray? I mean, pretty gutsy of Maggie and Art to bring up talking about abuse allegations or insinuations or whatever you want to call it. Pretty tense, kind of uncomfortable moments while watching the episode tonight.
Yeah, and that's legit. That was genuine stuff.
Oh yeah.
Fred was actually confused.
Yeah.
Where this question came from.
Yeah.
And you know, it's pretty obvious that he didn't take a deep dive into James Renner's book. When he said, is that something that was insinuated, between the lines?
Well, he was aware that it wasn't directly stated in the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the fact that that's kind of run, it's turned into its own monster. And I think he was genuinely shocked that now he has to, you know, it's out there. Now he has to defend that.
Mm-hmm.
What a weird thing that he's got to defend. And he says it. He's like, I don't want to do this. Now I have to do this. All I want is to figure out where my daughter is.
And he's aware that when you defend yourself, it makes you feel like it gives you a guilty conscience. And we talked about this last week. It makes you feel awkward. You feel like you're defending yourself against something that you don't think people would even think about you. Obviously, it made Fred very awkward. You could see it, you know?
Yeah. Let's see.
From Gina, have we heard any word on why they aren't releasing the footage of the ATM? And we haven't really heard any word on that, but I would say stay tuned on that one.
Yep.
Do you think, from Jesse, do you think Maura was murdered or went into hiding? Honestly, both scenarios seem unlikely, but when you look at this case, every scenario is unlikely. So I don't know. I don't know. It's a really tough one to say.
It's a tough question. It's an easy question to ask, but it's a tough question to answer because you can come up with some really good evidence for both things.
Yeah.
All right.
From Lara, they didn't have enough money for a car. What about financing, putting money down? That didn't make sense. And I don't know. The only thing I know about Fred is that he is extremely like an old school guy, and it's cliche at this point because we say it all the time about Fred, but he seems to have wanted to pay cash for a car.
Right.
I've been with someone who bought a car with $4,000 in cash. Exactly. So it's not something that doesn't happen.
Right. And I remember getting my first car, my couple first cars that I had, and it's always preferable for the parents to, They want to put the majority of the money down. They want to buy a car. If Maura is in school and she has to pay attention to her schoolwork and she has to do what she needs to do to be successful, I could see him saying, listen, I just want to buy a car outright. I don't want to have you like make payments on it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have you ruin your credit possibly because you might not be able to make the payments. So if I can find a car for about $4,000, let's go buy a car for $4,000. Right. And look at the car dealerships in the area. There are major car dealerships, but there are a ton of those little like garage dealerships that you can go and you can buy a car for $2,500 or $4,500 or whatever, and you can just pay for it outright. So I feel like that was the intention, was not to go finance a car. Also, they wouldn't have been doing that on the weekend anyway. You know, the intention was to go buy a car.
There's a woman who's in college who isn't really driving too far with it, so it's not necessarily something that, you know, she needed a brand new car for, or even, you know, a $10,000 car.
Right. Sarah here says, what initially got you guys interested in this case? I would say it's too long of a story right now. So if you want to check out the podcast.
Yeah, we go into that in depth in episode 55, I think it is, a new intro. But yeah, basically we started a documentary about the people who are obsessed with this case. And then we became obsessed ourselves.
And Jeff actually said earlier that he got into Canada in 2005 with just a birth certificate. He was with a bunch of guys, got in with a birth certificate. So maybe it does come down to where you cross. Maybe some of them are more strict than others.
Right. But there are always cameras. So
should be.
Yeah. But obviously you're not talking Maura Murray's license plate. So who knows whose vehicle it would have been.
Yep.
From Tony, has anyone ever looked into the bus driver? Yes, definitely. People have looked into the bus driver, Butch. In fact, he was given 2 lie detector tests, but he is unfortunately deceased at this point. So even if you were guilty, there's nothing we could do about it now. But I think it's maybe a stretch to call him guilty at this point. Let's see what happens in the next 3 episodes. I don't know.
If he got away with doing something to Maura, then that means he got away with, you know, he lied to the cops. He lied to his common law wife. There's a lot of people that he would have lied to get away like clean.
From Julie, do you think Maura was involved in the hit and run? I think Julie is talking about the hit and run at UMass with Patrit Vassy.
Oh, right.
With Patrit, who was struck by a car and ended up in a coma. No, we don't think that was anything that Maura was involved in. From Gina, any more on the neighbors in the series? That's what's probable to me. Also, you say in the first episode they are shady or could have things to hide. Of course, anybody could have things to hide. I don't know what is coming up in the series. All we know that's coming up in the series is what we've filmed with them. And I would say, I don't know if there's anything with the neighbors, probably nothing that we film with them is relating to the neighbors.
Yeah, there's a whole way of thinking up there. If you go up there, if you've moved up there, you go there to be isolated. You mm-hmm. go there to get away from the attention. And one of our friends who's on the boards here actually said, because everyone makes a big deal about the Westmans being secretive and not cooperative. And while all that's true, it would be weirder for them to suddenly come forward with a bunch of information. What they're doing is just they are behaving the way they're expected to behave. That's the way they've always been behaving up there.
Yeah.
So what's weird to us or what's suspect to us is normal to them. They don't want people on their property. They don't want to be asked questions. They saw what they saw. They did what they did. Faith called the police.
Right.
You know, she did what she had to do. What happened after that is out of her hands. And that's how they think.
And law enforcement says very clearly that if you call the police, almost always you are not involved in the incident that you call about. That is just playing the odds. I'm not saying you don't look at someone because they call the police, but typically that's what the case is. From Gina, if she is alive and comes forward, could she still remain unknown, or would police have to announce it to the family? That's a really good question. I don't know.
That's a great question, though.
It is. It's a very strong point.
Because what's the basis of saying, like, releasing it to the family? If she disappeared when she was an adult,
right,
and she didn't commit any crimes, and she wants to be off the grid, what would be the reason for the police telling the family other than, hey, you looking into this is wasting resources?
In the episode tonight, they talked about the allegations that Maura was running from the men in her life, and Maggie and Art said that what they've found so far through three episodes lacks motive to run away forever. You know, and the woman at the very end of the episode I thought was very interesting, Elizabeth Greenwood. She is an expert. She wrote a book on if you were to escape your life. Thought that was very interesting. She said to pull off a disappearance, it takes years to plan. Not days, not hours, right, not months, not Friday morning. Years. And she says that typically people get caught when they, because they can't stay away from their family or friends.
Right. And then you look at Maura's family dynamic, and you look at what was going on with Maura's family at the time. So the family dynamic was, although her parents were estranged, they still had a close connection to each other. Mm-hmm. It's just really hard for me to think that Maura didn't reach out to somebody while her mother was going through her sickness, and when she died on Maura's birthday. How do you not reach out to the family when that happens? The coincidence of that happening and you still stay silent is extremely, extremely strange.
It's such a huge life event when your mom passes away. So yeah, it's something that I find hard to believe that Maura could not speak to her family during that time.
Yeah. Jacqueline here says, does old Peter's road get plowed? Wouldn't think she'd choose an unplowed road. Well, as far as we know, it gets plowed up to a certain point. There was probably a layer of snow coverage on the road. That dilapidated little shack that was there, that dilapidated house. If you were to run down there, if you were to run from the scene, I mean, that seems like most logical, like you go up and you take a left.
We've said it since the first time we've been there, which was December of 2013.
Right.
That if I were in the situation and I'm trying to get out of this area right now, that's where I'm going.
Yep.
But Maggie in the show had a great point. It's like, why would you leave somewhere dangerous to go somewhere potentially even more dangerous or just as dangerous? It's freezing, you know?
Yep. And if you are running, what are you running from? You know, if you're running down that road, what are you running from? The cops because you were drinking? wouldn't you, there's too many scenarios for a smart person, which Mora was, to suggest otherwise.
Right.
A smart person is not running into the February woods. I would assume.
Right. From Melissa, do you think the age progression looked right? We know she always wore her hair up. Plus, Julie's face is not that round. It looked wrong to me.
I thought it was going to go in another direction.
It's really, I mean, you know, it's really hard to predict what Mora would look like. So they had experts do this. Didn't look like what Mora would look like to me now, but obviously I don't know what she would look like today.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a really good point. I'm not sure. I have no idea what to say. I guess it didn't look that right to me either.
I know. I'm just saying from my gut, it was like, oh, that's not what I would have thought.
Right.
And that's a good point. You look at Julie's face structure. You look at Fred Jr. You look at Fred. It's not round. There's more of a oval shape to it. There's more of a jawline.
Yep. From Johnny, have we spoken to the EMT Dick guy interviewed by Maggie tonight at the end of the episode? We have not spoken with Dick, but I think it's his story is very interesting. He's, you know, the one who noticed the rag, basically him and his partner.
Maria there saying, how extensive was the search of the surrounding area? Do you guys think it was thorough? Or did the cops drop the ball? This is something that we talk about. We touch on a few times. I think the search of the area was as thorough as it should have been at the time. These police officers deal with abandoned cars a lot, and the majority of those abandoned cars come back to someone who was drinking and driving and left the scene and came back when they were sober and collected their car after. That's a very common thing from what we've heard. And everyone gives the police a lot of crap about botching the search. 3 days after, they had helicopters, they had infrared, they were in the woods. I think it played out the way it was going to play out inevitably, initially. Mm. That they were going to say, there's alcohol in the car, this car's abandoned. It's pretty obvious that someone probably walked away from the car to sober up and not get a drunk driving charge. Once the information came in, once they figured out who was the owner of the car, once all of the phone calls were made, the search started. I think they did the best job they could have done being a 4-member police squad.
Searching
within the first like 3 or 4 days.
Searching the surrounding area.
Yeah.
You're talking about. Yeah.
Yep.
I thought it was really interesting when Art said in the conversation with us that he was a dispatcher when he first started in law enforcement. And it's not necessarily something that you would just write man in the car smoking cigarette.
It's funny, right?
Yeah.
It seems very specific.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I can think of is what you'd mentioned, which was maybe it was the dispatcher just taking liberties, but Art saying, well, that doesn't seem like it's as a dispatcher, you should be as detailed as possible and not take liberties.
Right.
But, you're not to, I don't want to seem like I'm talking down to anybody, but there's probably a difference between where Art did his dispatching and the Haverhill Police Department.
Are you talking down to me?
What I'm saying is it could have been one of many calls that dispatcher took that night.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, she said, Faith said, I see a glow in the car, maybe a cigarette. So the dispatcher could have just shorthanded man in car smoking cigarette.
What Art said is basically,
every time I try to justify it, though, every time I try to justify it, it sounds like that shouldn't have happened. Yeah. I want to dismiss this cigarette man thing, but every time I try to, it doesn't make any sense to me.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
Hopefully there'll be more info as we go along. From Johnny, were there any footprints around the vehicle in the snow? And yes, around the vehicle there were footprints, but not going into the woods, as that would be your follow-up, or most people's follow-up.
Could she have hidden in someone's shed? Melissa, could she have hidden in someone's shed, garage, etc.? Absolutely. That little house down Old Peters Road she could have ducked into if she'd known that it was empty. Other than that, it'd be pretty tough for her to have gone into a shed or a garage without there being footprints leading to the shed or garage.
Yeah. And that old dilapidated house is very odd, because when you were in there, right? So there were newspapers that were, there were stacks of newspapers that led up to was it March of 2004?
Yeah, March of 2004. There were newspapers and magazines. When you walk into that house, it looks like, and I say this a lot, but this is the case. It looks like a family had a dinner, put the dishes in the sink, and then said, okay, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
There's still clothes in the drawers, clothes in the closets. There was still shampoo in the shower, all while the house is falling down around everything.
Right.
The calendar, I believe, was 2005, 2004, 2005.
It was definitely recently right after 2004. Actually, there's a shot of it in our trailer. I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's March of 2004 was the last newspaper or magazine accumulated in that house. So just a couple more questions here, and then we got to get out of here. Aren't 911 calls recorded? Yes, they are. And that was one of the things that we really pushed for in this show, is if they could get those 911 calls, we thought that would be very helpful. I don't know that they got them.
That could be a stay tuned type thing.
It could be coming up in the series. Yeah. We do not know.
Yeah. And then Gina says here, which way were the footprints? I want to be clear. We don't know.
There's no direct. Around the car.
It was around the car. So when you look at Faith's account of what she saw, she says that there was a flurry of activity in the trunk.
At the trunk.
Yeah, at the trunk. So there's footprints around the car. I don't believe that there was anything found in any direction. Once you get onto the road was clear. So there was no footprints on the road. And the car was drivable.
Right. I really liked when Maggie said about Butch, the bus driver, that he's either an unreliable witness or he's hiding something. I think that's a really good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Because his story isn't accurate. You know, there are accounts of his story that vary.
I don't know. I'd say his story is pretty consistent. It's just the interpretations that have been taken from it.
I don't know about that. I'm going to challenge you on that
one. All right. Yeah. I mean, we can maybe next episode of the podcast, but I feel like his story has always been pretty straightforward.
Yeah. I think his story has changed. I feel like we've talked about that on the podcast in the past.
Interesting. Well, something to get into later on.
Enjoy the show. Enjoy the next three episodes. We will probably be back at some point doing another one of these.
Stop fighting.
We will probably be back at some point doing another Facebook Live chat. I don't think we're back next week. I'm not 100% sure, though. But thank you very much for listening and asking questions. We really appreciate it. Please enjoy episode 4, 5, and 6.
And I just want to say one more quick thing. All of the information that's been gathered by this show, all of the investigation that's going on, is being delivered in the best way that the production company sees fit. I mean, they only have 45 minutes or so to deliver this information. So take it for what it is now. Don't start getting too emotional about it in episode 1, 2, or 3. Keep watching. It's going to be something where once the final episode is done, you want to process that and you want to consider everything. They need to feed the information the best way they see fit.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate it.